Policy Centre podcast. Although it has been a decade since the Yogyakarta principles were developed, rights-based development organisations and humanitarian organisations have been relatively slow to address the rights and needs of LGBTIQ plus people within their programmes. The UNDP and World Bank have called for a research revolution into LGBTI inclusion based on indicators in development over 2017 and 2018. In response, researchers and practitioners on this panel at the 2018 Australasian Aid Conference discussed the rationale and methodology for LGBTIQ plus inclusion within humanitarian and development programs and how progress can be advanced.
Thanks everyone for joining us today. I am so excited to be here. I'd like to start by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land that we're meeting on today, paying respects to elders past, present and future. My name's Stephen Close. I work on humanitarian reform in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, and I'm really excited to welcome you to today's session. It's been a decade since the Yogyakarta principles applied the standards of international human rights law to address the abuse of human rights of LGBTI people. Global human rights mechanisms are addressing sexual orientation, gender identity and expression and sex characteristics with increased sophistication. But meanwhile, we'd like to know how can we advance progress among development and humanitarian organisations, whether rights-based or economically driven. We hope the evidence presented today from multiple perspectives contributes to addressing the research gaps to inform program design, responding to the call of UNDP and the World Bank for a research revolution on data on LGBTI issues and experiences. So we're joined by five exciting speakers. They'll be covering perspectives including the evidence on how excluding LGBT people affects broader development in Indonesia, a major developing country in which LGBT rights are currently particularly threatened. We're bringing together two concepts that are intimately integrated in real life but surreally siloed in our industry. Gillian Fletcher's presentation will look at how gender and sexuality intersect in development organisations in Southeast Asia. We'll be looking at the politics of donor engagement where human rights are violated, reviewing the case of engaging politically in Uganda. And we'll be looking at Down by the River, a project by Oxfam and Edge Effect, funded by DFAT, exploring inclusion of Fijian gender and sexual minorities pre and post-tropical cyclone Winston, using this temporal divide to identify pre-existing development inclusion of LGBTIQ people and strengths and challenges that this community faces in a humanitarian crisis, motivating global efforts to address SOGI-esque issues in DRR and humanitarian activity. While I have this opportunity, I would like to use this platform quite selfishly to share some key points from the perspective of the Australian government. I also believe personally that it's important for us as a donor organisation to have some accountability for our position on this issue. The Australian government believes that human rights are universal, indivisible and interdependent, and that all people are entitled to respect, dignity and legal protection regardless of their sexual orientation or gender identity, SOGI. Australia is a strong advocate for equal human rights, non-discrimination and non-violence for LGBTI persons globally. We carry out this through advocacy through both bilateral and multilateral channels, including the UN General Assembly Third Committee and the Human Rights Council. Australia is proud to be a member of both the UN LGBTI Core Group and the Equal Rights Coalition, a diplomatic network of 35 countries, and a donor to the Global Equality Fund. Australia also supports LGBTI NGOs to promote equal rights and development in the Asia-Pacific region and in Commonwealth countries. We do this through the Global Equality Fund and the Asia-Pacific Forum for National Human Rights Institutions and by working directly with LGBTI NGOs in country where possible. Australia makes representations on LGBTI issues through universal periodic review processes. ILGA, the Global LGBTI Peak NGO, has found that Australia is one of the most consistent makers of universal periodic review recommendations focused on LGBTI human rights. We strive to recognise positive progress as well as calling for better protections and equality. In 2017, Australia called for a range of greater protections of LGBTI human rights in 15 of the 28 states under review. In October 2016, Australia was the first country ever to make a specific universal periodic review recommendation encouraging action to promote and protect the rights of intersex persons. I have a particular interest and background in working in Pacific Island countries from my previous career working in the World Bank and also my current research on youth employment at ANU. And I'm interested in what is the context of LGBTI people in the Pacific. And I feel that while Australia has established engagement from a human rights perspective at a time of global unprecedented humanitarian need, there is a new opportunity to consider LGBTI inclusion in humanitarian action. And this includes the action and perspectives in the Pacific, including those presented in the Down by the River report. Some of the things that are going on in the Pacific is that the UN Women Fiji Multi-Country Office's Gender and Protection in Humanitarian Action Program is working with partners across the Pacific region. The October 2017 Pacific Humanitarian Partnership meeting featured presentations by LGBTI humanitarian responders. Under DFAT's Humanitarian Research Partnership with the Humanitarian Advisory Group, some of whom are represented at this conference this week, there is an imminent practice note on LGBTI inclusion in humanitarian action, and there is also upcoming Asia-Pacific regional consultation of humanitarian organisations facilitated by Edge Effect. So now that I've had the opportunity to account for some of Australia's position and activities on this very important but emerging issue in the development and humanitarian space, I'd like to introduce some of all of our presenters. MV Lee Badgett is a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and a Williams Distinguished Scholar at UCLA's Williams Institute for Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity Law and Policy. Her current research focuses on poverty in the LGBT community, employment discrimination against LGBT people in the US, and cost of homophobia and transphobia in global economies. She's done consultancies for World Bank and the UNDP, and her latest book is The Public Professor, How to Use Your Research to Change the World. Lee will be looking at LGBT exclusion in Indonesia and its economic effects. So as I've spoken enough for now, I will hand you over to Lee for her presentation. Thank you.
All right, well, I will plunge right in. Thanks for the introduction. I'm going to talk about a project that's related to a series of works that I've been working on over the last few years that looks at the inclusion of LGBT people and sort of moving in the direction of LGBTI people to look at how inclusion is not only good for LGBT people, which I probably won't have to convince you about, but also that it's good for all of us in the following sense, that LGBT inclusion means that economies are more fully using the skills, the knowledge, the abilities of people, and are really embracing the diversity of its population to best use that skill and knowledge in its economy and will actually have an economic effect. So inclusion is good for economies. And LGBT inclusion in particular is good for economies. So I'm going to flip that, though, in this particular report, which is work that I've done with colleagues at the Williams Institute, Amira Hazenbush and Winston Lahore, to look at exclusion, to look at the impact of LGBT exclusion, particularly in Indonesia, and to think about what its economic effects might be. So this project came out of an increasing concern that various institutions in Indonesia were becoming very much into an exclusion mode, whether it's in higher education, in the media, in terms of sort of enforcement of laws around criminalization of homosexuality. And we took this on to try to first document evidence of LGBT exclusion in Indonesia in as wide a way as we could find that's been done in the literature, and then to show how those patterns of exclusion actually affect the economy. So Here's the basic idea, as I just said in the introduction, that economic output from the perspective of economists is very strongly driven by human beings, and in particular by the skills and the ability and the knowledge that they have. And that is what we call in economics human capital. And the development of those skills, abilities, and knowledge comes about through really important institutional locations in our societies and economies, like education, employment, health, and in particular. And there are certain kinds of experiences that people can have that can create barriers to fully being included in society, fully participating in the economy, and using their skills and abilities to the highest level. And those would be concerns related to violence, to legal barriers, to health disparities, to lack of access to education, and lack of access to jobs. And so this is kind of the overarching framework that we're working within here. More specifically, in the context of Indonesia, we just want to acknowledge that the LGBT term is now very common, or LGBTI is now commonly used as a very much an all-encompassing term for sexual and gender minorities. It's very common in many countries in the West, but is increasingly being seen to be a useful organizing principle politically. It's being used by many global institutions like the World Bank and UNDP. But of course, these terms don't always map very clearly and very well onto locally specific terms. So just for instance, in Indonesia, the term waria is also used for people that we might otherwise think of as transgender women. That's one of the most common terms. There are many other kinds of gender categories that map onto sexuality as well. So the LGBTI term that we use here should be thought of as something that's intended to capture very broadly all the possible local permutations of sexual and gender minority identities there might be. Now, the other big challenge, aside from sort of thinking about who we're talking about, is that there was very little research or data that we could locate in the Indonesian context. And we looked both for work that's been done in English, but we had an Indonesian co-author, Winston Lahore, who also combed as many databases on work in Indonesia, research in Indonesia as possible. There's no nationwide body that's collecting this information. We do get some estimates of the numbers of men who have sex with men out of HIV-related studies. It's probably an undercount. As you can see on the screen, there are, you know, they range very widely from 38,000 to up to 3 million people. The studies that we were able to find also focused largely on, you know, the big urban areas. There's very little on lesbian, bisexual women, or transgender men. This is a very common theme, the big, huge gaps in our knowledge about those communities. Because a lot of this research is based on qualitative data collection methods, ethnographies, and focus groups, that sort of thing, we even the surveys that were done are very small, and they're not random samples. So we don't have the kind of data that lends itself well to easy comparisons, either across groups or with other countries. But you know, that's all the bad news. The good news is that we actually did find some studies in each of the areas that we're interested in: the health, education, employment, violence, and legal barriers. So there's enough there to talk about from an economic perspective and to sort of show how this economic perspective would work. So let's turn to those different areas. So first, legal barriers clearly exist. There are still local laws in Indonesia that criminalize homosexuality, and they are enforced. There are many other legal barriers that are very clear. Adoption's prohibited for same-sex couples. The access to ID cards is limited to people who, you know, are in the sort of the gender binary, male, female categories. There are big barriers to change for people who want to change their gender identity on their official documentation. marriage is limited to different sex couples. So just hitting on a few of the big categories that are often considered. And then there is no national non-discrimination law that explicitly protects LGBT people. There are provisions of the Constitution that would appear to apply to everyone, and yet they do not appear to have been used to apply to LGBT people. Public opinion is also not particularly welcoming. The Pew Research Center in the United States periodically does their global attitude survey, and their most recent survey asked the question, homosexuality should be accepted by society, and Indonesia was one of about 10 or 12 countries that scored below 10% on this. So I'm trying to remember exactly what Australia is. I want to say somewhere around 70 to 80% of Australians say yes, homosexuality should be accepted by society. However, fewer than 5% have said that in Indonesia since 2007. Another survey question that's been tracked over time is something a question that's something called the World Value Survey, which has been done since the 1980s. And the question, one of the main questions they ask there is which groups would you not want to have as your neighbor? And one of the options that people are supposed to answer have to do with homosexual neighbors. And two-thirds of Indonesians said that they would not want a homosexual neighbor, which is relatively high on a global scale. So we see both in principle and then more or less everyday kinds of practice that there's not a great deal of tolerance of homosexuality in Indonesia. The media portrayal is negative, and there's lots of documentation in the study that we did that's published on the Williams Institute website. But I'll just point out in particular that in February, just about 2 years ago, the Indonesian Broadcasting Commission issued a new policy that explicitly prohibited campaigning for LGBT people. So that was sort of reinforces and solidifies the attitudes of towards LGBT people. And when we turn to looking at experiences that LGBT people have, we found several studies that show that violence is quite common. These are not from population-based samples. But it's notable that the majority of LGBT people who have been surveyed have reported some kind of violence during their lifetime, and it's most often psychological violence, but sometimes also physical violence. The kinds of contributing factors that people point to have to do with the fact that they are not protected by the state or by law, that these individual values that we saw in the opinion surveys can give rise sometimes to vigilantism and a collective denial of rights to LGBT people, including violence, and law enforcement and militant groups are sometimes also part of this process. So now I want to just kind of tie each of these pieces to the potential kinds of economic effects that are likely to result from that we know from other kinds of research in other countries that could result from these experiences. In particular, here we're thinking about violence in schools, for example, leading to people quitting school or having to leave a job. Violence can have a very obvious physical or psychological impact on health. And it may also create housing, transportation, and other barriers. If people don't feel safe in public, taking public transportation to work, it would make it very hard to hold on to a job. So these things can also be linked together. Secondly, we know that there are healthcare barriers that LGBT people face in Indonesia, and that this can cause what psychologists and public health professionals call minority stress. So there are data that suggests there's a very high prevalence rate of HIV for Waria and MSMs, there in Indonesia there's lower HIV funding for MSM than other key populations. There are studies that suggest there's a high degree of suicidal thinking and attempts. People report very low self-esteem. These are all potential impacts of stigma, violence, and discrimination. And then people who do have healthcare concerns have difficult access to healthcare for transgender people. Lack of ID cards is very important. But for all LGBT people, practitioners tend to be ill-equipped, and in some cases to actively discriminate, to deny healthcare services to LGBT people. The potential economic effects of this kind of treatment can range from higher healthcare costs for society, not just for individual LGBT people, greater absenteeism from work, when people are at work, healthcare conditions can lead to lower productivity, and we also think about health as an important aspect of human capital that's lost when people's health is poorer than it should otherwise be. The education system is another key area that can influence not just the experiences of LGBT people in the short run, but can also matter a lot in the long run for economic opportunities. And here, the kinds of challenges people face range from family rejection, which can cause people to lose their family's financial support, and can eliminate their ability to continue in school. In schools, harassment and bullying can be a problem. We did see surveys that collected and compared educational achievements of different groups of LGBT people, and what we saw was that when it's possible to compare within these surveys, that Waria in particular had lower rates of education than MSM, which is the comparison that it's usually made to. So the potential economic effects are lower quality of education that people might receive if they're bullied and harassed is not a great learning environment, obviously. It may reduce the number of years people can stay in school, and these can all have effects on reducing the skills and knowledge of workers. And then finally, the last area that I'll talk about is employment, and employment discrimination clearly occurs. Indonesia is a country with a very large informal sector, and so that's also a very common source of employment for LGBT people. And there are barriers to formal employment. Again, the lack of access to documentation is a big problem for transgender people. All of those other things that I already talked about, health and education, can lead to lack of qualifications. And there appears to be a great deal of discrimination against gender nonconforming applicants, according to people who've been studied. Being fired, being harassed at the workplace are all quite common. And a telling study that was done by the ILO, the International Labor Office, suggests that about two-thirds of non-LGBT people that they surveyed were very uncomfortable with having an LGBT supervisor or coworker. So that's a very—that's a lot of people. If two out of three people that you work with are uncomfortable with you as an LGBT person, it's going to make it very likely that there will be some kind of problem that we would consider to be discrimination. And discrimination is obviously going to hurt the LGBT person, but there are larger economic effects that we know of. People who get put in jobs that don't use their skills will have lower productivity. Harassment in the workplace will reduce productivity. Keeping people out of the formal sector, where they may be more productive, is a sort of an overall loss of productivity to the economy as a whole. And these are the kinds of effects that will tend to accumulate over time when people get less training and experience, their future productivity will also be affected. So if we thought we could think about this in a dynamic way as well as at a point in time. The last thing I'll say is that we had hoped to be able to estimate an actual monetary cost of exclusion. So all these issues that we talked about with lost productivity in healthcare, reduced education can make a big difference. There are lots of studies related to these kinds of estimates for looking at gender discrimination or discrimination against ethnic and minority groups. The one study that I have done that was able to estimate an actual value for this was in India. This was for the World Bank. I was asked to create a model of the cost of homophobia, the cost of stigma and exclusion. And then later I used that model to actually calculate what that could look like in India using a slightly larger base of data than we have for Indonesia, and found that the cost was ranged from, depending on the assumptions, from 0.1% to 1.4% of GDP. And if those sound like small numbers, think about it like an economist would. If GDP suddenly fell by 1%, you would call that a recession. We would be very concerned about it. We would be encouraging governments to take action. And if this was true in India, this is also, if this same kind of effect size would be true for Indonesia, which has actually much worse public opinion measures than India does, leaves out a lot of other things that we couldn't actually look at in terms of economic effects. So even a conservative estimate of something like 0.1% to 1.4% of GDP means anywhere from $1 to almost $12 billion, U.S. dollars, in losses to the Indonesian economy each year. So those are the challenges that LGBT people face. But again, just to kind of put this in context, if these are challenges that have this kind of an economic cost, as a decreasing number of studies are suggesting that it does, then that's a problem for all of us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lee, for that powerful presentation, which presented the multifaceted impacts and the serious economic costs of LGBTI exclusion. And given this development context, which is part of the emerging very helpful evidence of the unique needs of LGBTI people and the impacts of their exclusion, the question arises of what development actors are doing in response. And so I would like to present the next presenter, Gillian Fletcher of La Trobe University, who became involved in development as a volunteer with VSO in Cambodia from 2000 to 2003. She's a co-chair of the ACFID Sexual Rights and Development Community of Practice with Emily Dwyer. She's active in reframing of ACFID Code of Conduct to include an intersectional approach to systems of inequity and marginalisation. She's an honorary fellow in School of Politics and Philosophy at La Trobe University and an associate with Edge Effect, a gender and diversity advisor to a local NGO in Myanmar, and a member of the editorial board of Culture, Health and Sexuality Journal. Gillian will be looking at the intersection of gender and sexuality in two development organisations in Southeast Asia. Thank you.
I really hate listening to myself described. Oh, did I really say I do all those things? Well, apparently I do, so there you go. I'm actually an honorary fellow, which I think is hilarious given my work on gender and sexuality. But there you go. Use the right computer, that's going to help. I'm just going to present today on a qualitative research that I did with some colleagues into conceptualizations of gender and sexuality within two Southeast Asian development organizations. And we're not identifying the country for reasons of confidentiality, and just to help people be open about it. And it was a collaboration between the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society, La Trobe, IDS UK, and two organisations. The first was a national branch of an international network, you can all read, I'm sure. And the second was an urban-based local NGO working on sexuality, poverty, lesbians, bisexual women, and trans men, but not trans women. And I have a confession to start with, which is we did this fieldwork in 2014, so I'm embarrassed to admit how long it's taken us to complete. But we've been coping with lots of changes, organisational management changes, and anyway, so that's the confession over. So now I'll move on. So all of the researchers, our primary starting point was the entwining of gender and sexuality. And anyone that's ever seen me present before has probably seen this quote because it says everything I think that needs to be said. Social construction and significance of one can rarely be understood without considering the other. And here are a few examples for people to think about. There's a growing body of work that documents the existence of sexual assault of men and boys. So, for example, a 2012 survey carried out by Fulu and others in the autonomous region of Bougainville, PNG, found that 32% of male respondents had experienced sexual abuse before the age of 18. And there's a great deal of sexual abuse of men in times of conflict, and that is obviously related to gender and sexuality. Similarly, sex workers across the world experience vast levels of stigma and discrimination, and that's often coming from other women. Again, it's gender and sexuality. And trans people are predominantly understood only through an LGBTIQ lens, or as Lee said, through an HIV lens. And it's also very interesting in Lee's speech when she talked about the broadcasting law and how the law actually bans the promotion of effeminate men. So again, you can see very clearly there the connections between gender and sexuality. So more background. Everybody involved in the project has seen a tendency within international development to treat gender and sexuality as separate, and Stephen, you noted that in the introduction. The other thing that really strikes me is this, that we approach both of them through what Connell has called categorical thinking. So we look at categories of people. And in gender is usually only understood as applying to women, but often not even applying to trans women. And there are some honourable exceptions to that. So the Fiji's women's movement involves trans women. IWDA has been following from their Fiji partner's lead and looking at various, the differences within women. But as a rule, if you ask people at field level, what does gender mean? They'll usually say women. And you won't see men on gender panels. It just doesn't happen. And in terms of sexuality, that's usually understood as applying to non-heterosexual people. And trans people will be included in there, even if their transitioning is nothing to do with their sexuality. They'll still get shoved in that box. And intersex people are usually just not even there. So what did we do with this long-term research? We started by asking each of the organisations to identify key documents that they felt had influenced their conceptualisation of gender and sexuality. We did participatory workshops, informant interviews. It was a pilot study, so we had funding constraints, and we were only able to examine two projects within one country context. And as you can see, there are small numbers of participants, but actually that represented the majority of the programme staff that were available within both organisations. Organisation A relies very heavily on volunteers in their fieldwork, and Organisation B works in a very small geographic area and is very much a sort of activist organisation. So although the figures look small, it was actually the majority of the people involved. We also held a workshop at the 2015 ACFID University Network, which is now RDIN conference, and the ethics approval was granted by La Trobe. So what did we find? Well, first of all, we found that the man-woman dichotomy was the fundamental organising principle of people's understanding of gender and sexuality. And I couldn't resist this poster, so it's not really applicable, but I really liked it, so I thought I'd shove it in. And it also became clear very quickly that there was a lot of confusion, as evidenced by the quote that I used as the title of this presentation. We also, this fundamental principle of the dichotomy between men and women was true even in work that sought to address issues of sexuality. So, for example, during a key informant interview with a senior staff member from Organisation A, we got this. Lee, can you see the slides?
Yeah, we should be screen
sharing. Okay. And in a workshop held with Organisation B staff members, which is the one that focused most on gender and sexuality, we were told about a lesbian sex worker who's a girl, not a lesbian, even though she has a female partner. So basically, if you look like a woman, you are a woman, but not a lesbian. And if you look like a man, but you're born as a woman, then you're a lesbian. Okay, so things got particularly confusing when we started speaking about trans people. So, for example, trans men are part of the sexuality axis. When they identify themselves as men, the first thing we do is respect them and their decisions. She thinks she is a man, she is a man. We will still work with him because he was born female. This is the point where my head just kind of exploded, basically. And in case anybody wants to know, the people we were working with are fluent in English, so this wasn't an issue of translation. And remember, this organisation does not work with trans women, and the reasons they gave us is because trans women have been assigned male at birth, and therefore they're assumed to have been brought up with what was understood as all-encompassing male privilege. and so the organisation wouldn't work with them. Other very clear example was under GBV. This is another one of my pictures I love, so shoved it in. And gender-based violence, it became clear it was only understood when the perpetrator could be constructed male, because male equals violent, whatever their lived identity. So we had this amazing story about a lesbian couple, or lesbian couples, and in this country, what this organisation has seen is that when violence occurs within lesbian couples, it's usually the femme who is perpetrating the violence. And they said to me, it's gender-based violence. So I said, well, how is it gender-based violence if it's the femme that's attacking the butch, who's the more masculine partner? And it's, well, the bi-femme one is basically taking on the role of the man in the house because she is taking on the role of the breadwinner, even though she is a bi-femme. So then I drew an image of two stick figures, because art is not one of my qualities. And I said, all right, so you've got these two figures, and the one that has economic power is beating the other one. Is that gender-based violence? And in the workshop, they had discussions, and they came back and they said, well, we don't know if they're a man or a woman, so we need more details. What's the identity so we can classify whether this is gender-based violence or what kind of violence is its form? Does one act as more masculine or more feminine? Who goes to the gym more? So none of this is intended to place blame on the organisations that we were working with or the staff members with whom we worked, because these people were struggling to make sense of what they saw in people's everyday life using the tools and the categories that they had been provided with by international development. And these are tools that in both instances, they both use tools that have been developed internationally, and all of the tools took a male-female categorical approach. So this is an example from...
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, I'm back over here.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
Sorry, I know.
This is a test. All right. Where do I... Oh, here?
Sorry,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
And so this is one of the examples from... It's a curriculum which is internationally developed, used by Organisation A, and their definition of gender is differences in the social roles expected from males and females. And then they went on to say socially or culturally defined ideas about masculinity, brackets, male roles, and femininity, brackets, female roles. So again, we're coming back to the sexed category. And I'm sure these words actually sound quite familiar to most of you because they're the definitions that get rolled out time and time again. But if you take a minute to consider them, it's black and white. We've got male and female all the way through. Even when they refer to masculinity and femininity, they are attributes attached to a sexed body, a body that's had sex assigned at birth. Back over here again. That was the second quote I didn't pull up because I got confused. And so what? You know, basically this is so what? Yes, it's a bit confusing, but we're doing our best. The problem is that categorical thinking, and this also applies to the grand alphabet soup of LGBTIQA++, it creates a false image of homogeneity within the categories that we use, whether they're men-women categories or whether they're the various queer categories. And that, in turn, back over here, it overwrites intersecting power dynamics. So it overwrites issues of race, of disability, of social economic status, and it also ignores the role of sexual norms in marginalising people within gender work. So I don't know about the rest of you, but most gender work I've seen does not actually pay attention to the specific needs and disadvantages experienced by sex workers. They're usually... You know, they're just invisible. There are separate sex worker projects, often within HIV, but within gender, despite the fact that these female, sex-assigned female at birth sex workers and trans women who sell sex are often the most disadvantaged people within communities, both economically disadvantaged and socially disadvantaged. Ooh, it's a bad habit. I can't break it. The other issue is that human bodies are actually not easily dichotomized. Does anybody know who this is a picture of? It's Ed Sheeran. Okay. So I'm including this photo of Ed Sheeran as a child because according to the USA-based Intersex Campaign for Equality, intersex people are about as common as people with red hair, which is 1 to 2% of the population in countries that are largely Caucasian. And yes, they get a mention in the alphabet soup, LGBTIQ, but how do we deal with intersex people if we have gender and sexuality work that thinks about, you know, monolithic foundations of men and women based on their sex characteristics? So, and the other thing, and this is from Connell, is that when the effect of this homogenization and this categorization is that when people talk about gender, they're actually talking about women, and usually certain kinds of women. So I'm ending with some challenges. I've got three challenges that I struggle with in my work all the time, and therefore I'm assuming that other people, it can't just be me, right? Other people must have challenges as well. And the first one is, how can we, as development practitioners or donors, find better ways of acknowledging and addressing the cultural and historical systems of norms, expectations, value judgments, and power relationships that regulate human interactions? How can we focus on these judgments of worth or lack of worth and not on the existence of differences in bodies? Because at the moment, that's what we're doing. We've got lots of boxes and we put people in it based on what we think their body is. How can we avoid unintentionally reinforcing stereotypes that all men are perpetrators of violence rather than potentially being a victim of violence, that all women are victims, that all lesbians are butch, that all trans men are really women and that all trans women are really men? How can we avoid this? Because, you know, we really need to be thinking about that. And just to end, this is a lovely quote from Smith, who wrote the entry on gender in Fuzzwords and Buzzwords by Cornwall and Eads. I don't know if most of you know that, but it's a fantastic book. And Smith talks about, you know, bland talk of gender and the possibility of orderly tools through which profoundly internalised beliefs and solidly entrenched structures are miraculously supposed to dissolve and be transformed. But it's not going to work. We need to do something differently. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gillian, and apologies for the technical issues there. And thanks for those very valuable questions. Indeed, it's a puzzle to find better ways of acknowledging and addressing cultural and historical systems, norms and expectations. And I was personally thinking a way that development actors often seem to deal with that is to avoid them and to get into the blandness of gender approaches and trying to avoid the very tough traditional cultural approaches. And that's why there is such an imbalance in developmental dealings between gender and sexuality, even when they're interlinked. So back to my theme of earlier of what do development actors do about it, I remember many of us felt quite strongly about the situation in Uganda and the actions of major international donors in response to the anti-homosexuality bill. I'd like to introduce Dr. Nihir Desandi, who's a lecturer and Birmingham Fellow in Politics and Development at the International Development Department at the University of Birmingham. He's a research associate with the DFAT-funded international research program, the Developmental Leadership Program, and you may have seen the presentation earlier this week. His research looks at the relationship between international development and human rights, the politics of reform processes, and the international political economy. And Nihir will be looking at how donors engage with human rights violations, looking at the case study example of the Uganda anti-homosexuality bill. Thank you.
So thank you very much. So, as Stephen said, I work with the Developmental Leadership Programme, and the space in which they work is very much along the lines of how donors engage with politics in their work. And it's this kind of shift that's happened over the last 10, 15 years, or perhaps going back a bit longer. And one of the issues that I found this shift, so I mentioned this yesterday for those of you that were at the launch of the DLP report, is that I feel like, so the start of this kind of shift towards engaging more with political thinking was acknowledging that there are trade-offs and dilemmas in the work that donors and development actors do. And I would say that over the course of that 15, kind of 20 years, some of that has been lost. And increasingly, so as David Hudson talked about this morning in the three-minute pitch, there's quite an instrumental view of politics often, and issues of rights have frequently kind of been lost in that conversation. So that's the basis of where that started. And so with a colleague of mine who's a political theorist, Leo Arez, we started thinking about, okay, what are these dilemmas that are involved with how donors respond to human rights issues and what are the different ways in which they should be thinking about it? And kind of this sort of follows up from that. And it's very much a work in progress. And there are a few issues I'm not sure about within the paper, so any feedback would be much appreciated. So the context, I don't know how similar it is in Australia, I assume it's quite similar, is that there is a huge amount of pressure on aid budgets. So in the UK, development assistance is coming under fire from media, from the public, from a number of politicians. And one of the main issues that gets raised in criticising aid is actually this issue of human rights and the fact that we're providing aid to regimes that systematically violate human rights or where human rights violations take place. So often the focus is on kind of the Daily Mail in the UK, but actually it's a broad range of kind of media that highlight what is a really important issue. And so it's a question of how we start to think about it. So there is a literature, so my background is political science, there's a huge literature that looks at this issue of how do donors respond to human rights abuses. And the implicit assumption, so there's a whole kind of wave of quantitative studies that look at, you know, do donors take human rights into account when they provide aid? The implicit assumption, sometimes explicit, is that they should be withdrawing aid or reducing aid in the face of human rights issues. And the other kind of common critique, so William Easterly, Angus Deaton have also made this kind of critique, it's about reducing aid and speaking out against human rights violations, which intuitively make a lot of sense, and I think a lot of people would agree with that certainly something should be done. And the failure by aid donors to do anything in response is generally taken to be a signal of a lack of commitment to human rights by aid donors. And so the argument I'm making is effectively that the conventional view is kind of built on a lot of assumptions that haven't really been unpacked very well or considered very well. And so the kind of link to the TWP, the thinking, working, politically work that Developmental Leadership Programme does is trying to bring in that political thinking. So what would a kind of more politically informed approach to looking at how donors engage with human rights issues look like? So the argument is effectively that, you know, this assumption that this should be an automatic response, that withdrawing aid, speaking out is necessarily the best approach, is problematic, and there are issues with that approach. So the caveats are, this is certainly not an argument saying human rights shouldn't be a major focus of donors. It's quite the opposite. It's that this should be at the forefront, but how do we do that? And it's not an argument that aid withdrawals in any circumstances are unwarranted. So there are certainly occasions when it makes sense, and it might be the only or the best option would be to withdraw or divert aid. But it's a case of when is that the most effective, and what can donors do to effectively address the human rights issues on the ground, so to best support those that are facing repression or abuses. So in terms of this standard view, there's a number of issues that I think need to be considered more closely in looking at how donors respond to human rights violations. So some of the limitations of let's say, this conventional approach. So the first, and this was the focus of the paper that me and Leo did, is that there is a dilemma involved here. So Unless we believe that aid is only going towards the governments of the countries that are being supported by aid, there is a fundamental dilemma here, and that is that if aid, and I'm sure many of us, I mean, there's issues over how aid is used, but if aid is being used to improve people's lives, to kind of fund education, health, simply withdrawing aid in response to human rights violations involves a real ethical and political dilemma, because effectively what you're doing is saying, because of this human rights abuse, we now think the appropriate response is to stop funding these other programs, or at least to divert them from where we were. So that may be warranted again, but there is a dilemma in how we approach that, which often doesn't get taken into account when these in a lot of the literature and when these kind of conversations happen. Another issue is looking at the influence of aid and conditionality on recipient governments. So there may be cases where, because the issues are so pervasive, so there's a great book by Peter Ruben looking at kind of the Rwandan genocide and the lead up to that, and looking at the fact that donors continued to pour aid into the country when it was clear that things were going wrong. So that is it's quite a clear kind of context where, you know, withdrawing aid, even if we don't think it's going to change necessarily, the aid withdrawal will change the behaviour of the government, is clearly kind of a warranted or a kind of needed approach. But more generally, the assumption is if we withdraw aid, somehow we're either incentivising governments or to kind of respect human rights, or at least we're delegitimising those governments. So that's part of the assumption. And again, there's an issue of, there's almost no conversation about how dependent is this government on aid, and does that influence our decision in whether we go towards kind of suspending aid, withdrawing aid in response to human rights violations? The other issue, and it links to this next point around the politics of human rights in developing countries, is there's a massive assumption to say that because as a donor we've withdrawn aid, we're now somehow reducing the legitimacy of that government. It assumes a lot about the way that human rights violation is viewed. So one of the big kind of issues in this kind of standard approach is there's quite a simple narrative of human rights in developing countries, which is that when we see human rights violations, it's a kind of autocratic, repressive government that simply wants to keep the majority of the people kind of under its control, which in some cases may be true, but actually the dynamics of human rights violations are often quite different. And so, I mean, in the Uganda case, it's that, you know, the violation was widely supported by the population. The public had a wide amount of support. So actually looking at, A, whether what the kind of public opinion, what the popular kind of view on the types of rights violation we're looking at, it effectively needs to be taken into account. The other issue that almost never comes up is the role of local actors. And so civil society groups are engaged with human rights on the ground. So in the Ugandan case, a big kind of civil society movement to try and prevent the law being passed. Again, very little thinking of, okay, if our response is that A, donors should be speaking out and withdrawing aid, how does that impact the civil society workers on the ground who were at the front line of engaging with those rights violations? And the last point around this, and hopefully some of those points will be a bit clearer when I look at the Uganda case, is around the domestic politics of donor countries. So I haven't quite worked out what I want to say with this, but a friend and colleague at the University of Birmingham, Jonathan Fisher, he's done some interesting work looking at when DFID in particular chooses to kind of suspend or divert aid in response to rights violations. And what he found is that it's generally driven by media coverage and public opinion in the UK. It's not driven by whether it's the right approach, whether they think it would have been an effective approach. It's increasingly being driven by this fear of that kind of media backlash. So again, it's thinking about how that domestic politics is going to inform the way donors respond. You're not the only one that did that there. So the case I'm going to look at is in looking at this case, it's effectively it's trying to kind of highlight some of these issues that kind of go with this kind of common approach to understanding how donors should respond. So, and I should say actually that this, so I don't know if many of you were at the kind of, so the other thing that DLP has been involved with was the Gender and Politics and Practice report, synthesis of studies that was also launched yesterday. So this was originally going to be part of this, And it's kind of interesting. So the reason it wasn't was because someone at DFAT was, for I think, you know, reasonable reasons, was worried about the sensitivities around this case study. So I think that's quite an interesting issue as well in terms of how donors engage with these things. So the Ugandan anti-homosexuality bill, so a very quick kind of overview of it. So like many former British colonies, you've had kind of anti-sodomy laws that were imposed by the British under the colonial era. Since those laws have basically been in place since then. So homosexuality is already criminal, is already criminalised. What you then saw in Uganda was a civil society movement to push for greater, for LGBTI rights in the country. And at the same time, you also saw the kind of rise of growing popularity of certain kind of evangelical churches, particularly US-based, who were really pushing this anti-gay, homophobic agenda in the country. So you saw this clash of two different kind of forces. And this was around 2000, it was in the lead up to 2009. An MP, a first-term MP called David Bahati, proposed an individual private members bill, which was to effectively introduce much harsher legislation towards. So it included, in the initial bill, it included the death penalty for homosexuality. It had stuff around kind of aggravated homosexuality, which was effectively kind of links. If your NGO is working with homosexual groups, you also could face issues. If you didn't report someone that you suspected or knew to be gay, you would also potentially, you would be breaking the law if this bill was passed. What happened is you saw a very kind of immediate response by a number of donors, including the UK particularly. The government of Uganda initially was certainly, and throughout actually, until very late on, opposed to the bill. So the actual executive, so Museveni, and the actual kind of executive in Uganda was very much opposed to this law and had made that quite clear the whole way. But the bill had huge popular support within the country. And it was particularly popular with some very influential religious leaders in the country. And so you saw a number of MPs that were really pushing for this law to be implemented. Around 2013, a few years down the road, so donors have tried to respond through advocating, through individually kind of contacting each of MPs involved, through a number of different means. What you saw is in 2013, the issue arose again. It was passed in Parliament. Museveni signed the law, and then within 6 months, it was repealed through the Constitutional Court. So that's a really bad and short, hurried overview. But just to go through some of the issues. So in thinking about how donors should have responded, one of the issues was it was a bill that had huge amounts of popular support within the country. And that was the reality of it. So that shaped the way in which donors in Uganda certainly wanted to respond, which was through what's called quiet diplomacy. It has a very kind of, a lot of people are very critical. That should say, GOUI was writing a presentation about Myanmar at the time as well, so it should be the government of Uganda. But effectively, the kind of approach was to have very frank conversations. There were conversations being held, so there were higher level statements being made by politicians, but the kind of main approach was this quiet diplomacy behind the scenes tackling of the bill. The use of aid conditionality, so this was a threat that was used very early when it looked like the bill might be passed, and it was kind of, it came back regularly. So again, so speaking to someone that worked closely with the USAID, you know, this is fundamentally one of the issues at play, which is that, so particularly for the Americans who don't provide direct support to the government, you know, a lot of their funding was going towards antiretrovirals. So the notion that you would cut antiretroviral funding if this bill was passed, there's a lot more to be said about, which I don't have time to say, about how, you know, what kind of language, what kind of principles we're trying to impose when we're struggling for human rights, and whether, I mean, for want of a better kind of, whether holding to ransom a government over whether they pass a certain bill is the right way to approach these things. So there was a coalition of civil society actors in Uganda that formed to create a formal coalition. It's the Civil Society Coalition for Human Rights and Constitutional Law. The letters aren't any easier to say, so I'll call them the coalition. So they released a statement, particularly after the bill was signed, where they were very much opposed to this. And there were a number of reasons. So one is that there is a backlash that they faced by this, which was very much the case. The other issue is, again, it's that, so when I interviewed some of the activists involved, it's like, you know, we're talking about our family members, our grandparents who are also benefiting from this. So how do we go about cutting this? I've timed this really badly. So another issue is, again, with the kind of unintended consequences of speaking out. So a big incident that, so the bill was being quietly pushed out for a couple of years. There was then a big incident at the Interparliamentary Union where the Foreign Minister of Canada, John Baird, brought it up in a meeting where Rebecca Kadaga, who was the Speaker of the House in Uganda, was present and kind of highlighted Uganda's problem as being homophobic. And this really kind of kick-started the whole debate in the country. It led to a huge kind of backlash within the country, and the issue was transformed from one of kind of human rights to one around kind of Western imperialism and Ugandan sovereignty. So there's a lot more that I could say about that and probably should, but how we kind of avoid that reframing of the debate so that it's actually around human rights rather than around these things. Donors continued to respond to the act, including engaging like the police, the health force, to ensure that they wouldn't target the LGBTI community even after this bill was passed. This was used as an argument from some donors of why that continued engagement is really important, that cutting off aid in certain cases is going to end that debate, end that ability to influence these things. And at the end, what influenced it, what seemed to be the major influence, which is something that donors raised, was the decision by a Chinese garment factory not to build a factory in Uganda because they were worried about how consumers would respond to that. So again, it's about bringing in other actors. I haven't explained that very well, but I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nahir, and I'd just like to confirm that DFAT official was not me. I, if anything, have a tendency to overshare, and that doesn't extend to selling filing cabinets. I did want to riff on that topic of donor quiet diplomacy, and from the donor perspective, it's so quiet that I'm not going to speak about it very much, but we don't engage where engagement puts LGBTI people at greater risk at that time, but I am confident that this quiet diplomacy is part of the toolkit that happens behind the scenes. And now we turn to the Pacific and the Down by the River report from Fiji. EdgeEffect is a Melbourne-based social enterprise that assists international humanitarian and development organisations to work in genuine partnerships with sexual and gender minorities. Emily Dwyer is Managing Director. Emily's first career was in radio journalism in Australia and Southeast Asia, and she entered the development world in 2004 as a radio journalism trainer in Afghanistan. For 4 years, including establishing the UN OCHA Humanitarian Radio Service. She has since worked in democracy and governance, civil society strengthening, humanitarian information, peace building and youth projects. Lana Wolf is the Community Engagement Lead at EdgeEffect. Lana has 20 years of experience in community and cultural development in health and human services, with experience in regional, rural and remote communities and Indigenous communities, and policy expertise in consumer participation in recovery-oriented service practice. Thank you, guys.
Well, thank you very much. And it's wonderful to be here on behalf of Oxfam Australia, Oxfam in Fiji, Rainbow Pride Foundation, to present the findings of the Down by the River report for the first time. If you don't have a copy, there are copies down the front, and it is also available online. It is a report and a project that looked at the rights and needs and strengths of sexual and gender minorities before, during, and after Tropical Cyclone Winston. And the battery's running low.
Oh, would have helped if this was on, hey.
So I wanted to unpack a couple of things there. Firstly, we're talking in terms of sexual and gender minorities here, and we do that quite deliberately because in Fiji, along with other parts of the Pacific and the rest of the world, there's a variety of sexual and gender identities that exceed the boxes of LGBTIQ quite dramatically. So we're talking about LGBTIQ people or people of diverse sexual orientation, gender identity and sex characteristics when we're talking about sexual and gender minorities or SGM. Most people here would recall Tropical Cyclone Winston, a Category 5 storm that devastated parts of Fiji in February 2016. And Oxfam comes to this particular project because as part of their response, they undertook research that suggested there are some vulnerable groups that hadn't been addressed in Tropical Cyclone Winston response. EdgeEffect, for our part, had been looking at the experiences of sexual and gender minorities in a variety of other disaster contexts. So, for example, in the Philippines, in Indonesia and India. And a small but emerging body of work to suggest that there is ongoing exclusion of sexual and gender minorities in programs before, during and after disasters and complex emergencies as well. In the case, so we came together to consider, well, was this also the case in Fiji? So initially we did some literature reviews, took a look at some of the projects and some of the assessments that were done in the aftermath of Tropical Cyclone Winston to see what did they say about sexual and gender minorities. Well, the UN Flash Appeal, the document on the right there, does talk about vulnerable groups but says nothing about sexual and gender minorities. The rapid gender assessment that was done the month after Tropical Cyclone Winston, well, you might expect that to say a little bit more. You might expect it to touch on diversity of gender identity, possibly gender expression, in particular because Fiji does have a third gender group, the Vakasealoa. But there are only passing references to LGBTIQ in that assessment. And finally, the post-disaster needs assessment that came from the government of Fiji itself makes two mentions of sexual orientation, though doesn't touch on gender identity or gender expression or sex characteristics for that matter either. The first mention, to give the report credit, says that sexual orientation and disability, amongst other characteristics, are crucial, which is great. The second mention, though, was this footnote, number 124, that no information was available on issues related to sexual orientation. And so the beginning and the end of the analysis in the PDNA about the differential experience of sexual and gender minorities of Tropical Cyclone Winston, well, that's where it started and stopped. And that lack of information and lack of data that has been mentioned a couple of times in this session so far means that for organisations reading the PDNA or reading these other documents wouldn't necessarily come to their attention that there are sexual and gender minorities who have specific challenges and where there are specific needs and programs that might be needed to be put in place. Given that that information wasn't available, we decided that we needed to go to find it because this is an action research project. It was designed to influence policy and practice in Fiji and elsewhere, and we adopted a storytelling methodology.
Yeah. So the methodology we used was a community mapping, story sharing and telenoa sessions. We use these methods because in the Pacific, storytelling is a familiar way of sharing information as well as making sense of it. In traditional telenoa, people not only share their stories, but they make sense of their stories by listening deeply to others. Secondly, we chose these methods because they help establish trust and rapport with the people who have a really good reason to be cautious. Our participants were invited through the Rainbow Pride community contacts, and we went through an extensive consent process to protect the privacy of participants. We know there are participants that had never spoken to anyone else about their sex or gender identities. Some were not out, and many had been on the receiving end of discrimination and at times horrific abuse because of their often considered taboo behaviours and identities. You will see in one of these slides participants participating in a community mapping process, and in this process people collaboratively created maps of their villages, and the purpose of it was prompting people to think about where they went and who they went with, which services or people they would go to and which ones they wouldn't go to, which spaces were safe places and which places were unsafe spaces. This helped prompt the participants when sharing stories about their experiences during Tropical Cyclone Winston, but also pre and post Winston. Overall, we collected 30 stories, and they were from a range of people with differing sexual and gender identities, from lesbians or lesbies, to gay men, to men who called themselves MSNs, to trans, to bisexual, to Vakasealoa. We had people of differing ages, from 18 to people that I would respectfully call aunties and uncles, being Fijian myself, and from people of different ethnic heritages, from Fijians with traditional connections to family, village, island, to Fijians who have parents from other Pacific islands, to Fijians of Indian heritage. We had people from urban, rural, regional and remote areas, people from different class backgrounds, different educational backgrounds, and we had stories that reflected all of this diversity. Choosing just one story to highlight the depth and complexity of individuals' experiences, we have a young man. And as a child, he experienced violence from his school peers and who told of his friends being assaulted by a teacher. He found it preferable to run away from home and live in cartons stealing food than live at home and go to the school he did. He was able to find help from a town hairdresser, and he lived in the shop helping out to support himself so he could send himself to school. And this is someone at the age of 10. When he did finish school, he left his island and got a job in a factory. In the share house he was renting didn't accept him, so he was once again kicked out. He told us about finding acceptance in the SGM community, and when his home and community were devastated by the cyclone, only getting help from the SGM community. He spoke about ongoing discrimination post-TC Winston and how the community blamed sexual and gender minorities for TC Winston, and how we sought help from a friend who was a police person, but they said they couldn't help. He spoke many times of how the discrimination he faces, not just from individuals and communities, but the justice system, the education system, workplace discrimination, discrimination in the church and in the medical system. Collating all the stories, we were able to clarify four priority areas. The livelihoods and early recovery theme focuses on discrimination and marginalisation in education, workplaces and families that undermines livelihoods development, increasing the impact of stresses and shocks during disaster and post-disasters, reducing capacity of recovery. As you will have noticed from the previous story, there were lots of connections to pre-disaster discrimination in school, home, workplace and family that impacted that person. But there's also post-disaster discrimination. Just a snapshot from one of the stories. Trying to get the house back to normal, trying to get the kids back to school, it was a real struggle. There was some help other children were accessing, but because we're LGBT women, we can't really tap into that. Many of the stories with housing, shelter and wash themes recount challenges of securing safe housing before TC Winston due to everyday violence in family homes, young people running away from home or being kicked out of home. However, the stories also address challenges finding safe spaces during the aftermath of TC Winston and through rebuilding and finding longer-term housing solutions. Still today, we are moving from place to place, looking for a fixed place to stay and live like a normal lesbian couple. If the housing assistance by the government was granted to people like us, we would have already built a house. That was over a year after TC Winston when we collected that story. Violence, harassment and trauma themes were picked up with stories about exclusion from family, community and faith, leaving people isolated and cut off from their social networks. Furthermore, they were often blamed for causing Tropical Cyclone Winston, and that was placed on their shoulders. You know, often it seemed there was no escape from violence. Last year, a brother cousin was drunk and started yelling and shouting at me to stop dressing like this. He started beating me. I ran under the bridge and I was crying and crying. I asked God why he made me like this. One of the few respites we found was in the final theme, Strengths of Informal Networks. When we talk about informal networks, we mean the loose networks of friends who support each other in differing ways. Chosen family are people who function in closer relationships like family members they no longer have. Participants shared many stories in the which networks of friends and chosen family ameliorate social isolation and help people access information and support services. After Cyclone Winston, I went to my friend's house, who is a trans woman. The wall of her bedroom was gone and her clothes gone. We had to share clothes and things. I don't know if I would be here if we were not friends.
So those stories and the themes in those stories certainly resonated with the kinds of case studies that we had seen coming from disasters in other countries. Briefly, that all of the kinds of discrimination and marginalisation, in some countries criminalisation, leads to pre-emergency vulnerability that makes it that much harder for people to survive and to bounce back after a disaster. That the criminalisation, the discrimination and marginalisation, of course, doesn't stop just because there's been a wave or an earthquake, it continues. But also that for DRR and humanitarian actors, there was limited policy and practice resources for them to draw upon to address any of these challenges. There are 25 recommendations that are in the report. I can't go through all of those, but we'll get to a couple in a moment. There are a couple of discussion points that came up. We had a workshop with sexual and gender minority civil society organisations, DRR and humanitarian actors in Fiji. And one point that came out of that discussion is that while acronyms like LGBTIQ might suggest that there's one solution to these problems, that's far from the truth. And the shelter stories that we heard, a selection here from show that lesbians, trans men, trans women, gay men, people of a variety of sexual and gender minorities experience different kinds of discrimination in everyday life and have different preferences and different needs in emergencies. And that means that organisations that are providing shelter in humanitarian response need to be able to address that diversity of people wanting to go to one place or another. After an emergency, it's not always possible for everyone to get everything that they need, but what we might be able to talk about is referral pathways, so that if a gay man is not comfortable being in a shelter with heterosexual men because they were beating him yesterday, is there a way that he can be referred to some other place? And that brings us back to informal networks, because often it's not going to be an organisation that can provide that safe space. It's going to be an informal network member who might have a safe house that they can share. Another discussion point that came up a lot was the need to go beyond tokenism. And by this we mean that simply adding LGBT or sexual and gender minorities or some other phrasing to the end of already long lists of affected communities or marginalised groups is really only a tiny step forward. And this, in the workshop that we helped to facilitate in Fiji, we considered some advice that came from the Interagency Standing Committee to the Shelter Cluster, advice about gender inclusion. And you can see here that in the top of the document, it does mention that shelter organisations should talk with LGBTQI members along with other vulnerable members of the community. However, it became clear looking at the checklist below this that that commitment to talking to LGBTQI people in this case hadn't resulted in this advice, people considering underlying assumptions that everyone is heterosexual, that everyone has the same gender identity through their lives, and that everyone is binary, that those assumptions were built into points like, is the site safe and accessible for women and girls? Which, of course, is a perfectly reasonable and good question to ask. But one could also ask, is the site safe and accessible for trans women? If trans men are using bathroom facilities set up for men, is that safe for them? If gay men and boys are using those bathroom facilities in an emergency shelter context, is it safe for them? And there were other examples in here that we don't have time to go through where there are underlying heteronormative, cisnormative and binary assumptions. There are 25 recommendations. I say can't go through all of them, but they're grouped into three categories. There are policy and practice recommendations, for example, that address the National Disaster Management Organisation and shelters, including shelters outside of the protection cluster, because one thing that came out of this is that our response needs to be across all of the work that we do. It's not good enough just to handball this to the protection cluster or to the human rights folk. There are also community-focused recommendations, for example, to provide support for families that might have sexual and gender minority members, because that will help those communities to be so much more inclusive. And, of course, further research. This was just a small project, and informal networks is an example of where we need to do more research. We don't yet know so much about the durability of informal networks in post-emergency situations. We don't know much about how far they extend, how far they reach beyond urban and peri-urban areas, and we don't know how inclusive they are. If they're networks for gay men or different networks for lesbians, and are sex workers involved in any of those. We have to finish up. I would encourage you to read the report. What's next is hopefully more work in Fiji, but also taking this work elsewhere in the Pacific and around the world, because this is certainly not a problem just for Fiji. But the policy and practice resources that our organisations need don't yet exist, and we're hoping that you might help create them.
Thank you.
Thank you to all our presenters. I hope you feel stimulated, excited, and drenched in the wave of information that is part of the research revolution on LGBTI inclusion. As we have such a short amount of time left, I'm not going to attempt to sum up, but I am going to call for up to three very punchy questions from the audience, and we'll see if we have time to answer. Thanks. Yep.
You know, so gender exists on a spectrum, sexuality exists on a spectrum. We need sequencing now as well in development. And I find my reference briefly is I worked in Ethiopia, homosexuality is illegal, but even sex being talked about, it's kind of, you know, it's coming up. So human rights are not meant to be, you know, divided. But when it comes to these issues, how does it work if you get traction in certain countries around certain aspects? You know, do you go with them and how do you build the evidence base for what to do next? You know, it can be a more of a pioneer approach and then there can be others that come behind that. But of course that works for the person who comes first, but maybe not for others. So I guess I'm after your experience or perspective. And even on donors and human rights, I mean, it's the same kind of tension, right? You're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't sometimes. So how does it work?
Great, thank you. Second question.
I have a question. You talked a lot about working with communities and governments and trying to shift attitudes and behaviours there. I'd just like your thoughts on starting at home first with our own organisations in light of the shift to TWP over the last few years, and are there lessons learned that we can do to shift the attitude of our own organisations in so I guess issues.
Quite timely, given TC Geeta in Tonga this week. So my question really is around the humanitarian response. And so you mentioned a moment ago about the cluster, the social protection. I guess the question is, how do we get greater collaboration across those clusters at the time of the immediate response, and then afterwards?
I might just take them up, take the questions in reverse and pass them along as we go. So in terms of humanitarian response and Geeta, I mean, I think one of the things that's really important is to work in this across the whole cycle. So it's really hard to sort of lob into a country and all of a sudden engage with sexual and gender minorities and even sexual and gender minority CSOs, because there's often a lot of trust building that needs to happen. And so it's really important for organisations that have enduring presence in these countries to be building relationships with sexual and gender minority communities and civil society organisations all the time, so that so that when we have a disaster or complex emergency context, those relationships and the understanding of those communities locally really exist. I think it's really important that local sexual and gender minority communities are engaged with the local cluster system. And because there's so much different diversity of sexual and minorities in different countries, that it really is important to work through those local organisations. But those local organisations are often volunteer-led, they're often resource-deprived, and so there's a need to support those organisations in different ways so that they can be part of what is often an arcane DRR and humanitarian system. So that's maybe a couple of ideas there.
I'm going to give one answer to all three questions, because I'm basically quite lazy. What I was trying to say with my talk was that if we take a categorical approach, then we're always thinking, okay, we work with women, and then we work with the queers, and then we work with disabled people, and yada, 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 yada. And we don't actually stop to think about inequalities within those separate groups. So in terms of human rights and not meant to be divided, in terms of shifting attitudes within our organisations, also in terms of humanitarian responses, I think we really need to go back to doing on-the-ground analysis of inequality and marginalisation. Who are the people on the ground in this place who are most excluded? Who do we not see in this space? So instead of just saying, okay, so we have to deal with the needs of all women and all children and then all disabled people, in every place, let's think, who is not who is on the streets? Who has no access to any other resources? And let's work with them in that place. And in our organisations, you know, I mean, frankly, I've stopped working with international organisations. I work with a local CSO in Myanmar, and we do a diversity approach. It has to be called gender and diversity because we have to have gender in the title for the donors to fund it. And it's trying to get people to think outside boxes and go back to very basically saying who are the most marginalised and excluded people and what can be done with them using their resources and their skills and to make them visible, not just these kind of roll-out, massive, one-size-fits-all approaches.
So in terms of the donors and the damned if you do and the damned if you don't, so I think... So one of the things, and it was specific to this context, and I do think that it's not just a cop-out to say, obviously, each context is going to require a different approach, but yeah, there was a civil society movement there to protect the rights of LGBTI people. There was a coalition formed. So one of the things I didn't say was, in terms of how donors responded, so initially there were some, I guess, teething problems in that relationship between the civil society coalition and donors, but actually over time that worked quite well. And one of the things was that the civil society groups were dictating when donors should speak out. So it wasn't a case of, and I don't think I made that clear at all, it wasn't a case of it should always be quiet diplomacy and behind the scenes. It was that there are times when actually, if this isn't in the news, civil society groups wanted the lobbying to be done in like behind the scenes. They didn't want it to be back in the media on the front line kind of issues. But then if it did, they often did ask donors to speak out when things looked like they weren't going well. So it was, so it is a much more kind of strategic approach. So I don't think there is going to be an obvious, damned if you do, like there isn't going to be an obvious kind of, this is how donors should respond to human rights. Mm. The other issue about the kind of inseparability of human rights, one of the big issues in, so one of the issues was that it got transformed from this kind of human rights issue to an issue of, oh, this is about Ugandan sovereignty and standing up to Western power. And part of the reason that that happens is because of the inconsistency with which human rights are approached. So it became very, within Uganda, it became seen as, and to quote Museveni, you know, in these countries there's a big gay lobby, so they have to speak out on these issues. Whereas on other issues where you've got political opponents being beaten up, there isn't that kind of pressure. So one of the things, I guess, that comes out of it is the need for more consistency on how human rights are tackled and actually to really address that in that kind of way rather than picking and choosing how we go about it.
I'm not sure if Lee has any comments, but I'll throw one thing in and then throw down the line. Just in terms of organisations walking the talk themselves, and I remember having going through onboarding processes in different NGOs, and we'll often do a child protection training, there'll be a gender training, there'll be an Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander People's Cultural Competency course, and yet to work for an aid agency where there was a sexual and gender minority cultural competency process. And I think building the skills and an understanding of people within agencies in Australia and in other countries is certainly a great place to start. I think one of the challenges for organisations wanting to do work in this space is that there aren't yet really a great range of policy and practice guidelines. There aren't the values clarification exercises or the models that are easy to turn to, and that's a little bit tragic, but it also means there's an opportunity for us to work on that. In terms of where to start, it can often seem really hard and really difficult. It might, and you know, sometimes when we're talking with different organisations about including sexually gendered minorities, we might focus more on existing gender programs and then so ask a question for, okay, so there's a Eliminating Violence Against Women and Girls program, and which women and girls are included and excluded? Is the violence against lesbian, bi, trans, intersex and queer women included in the conceptualisation of this program? But then also we want to push beyond, I guess, framings of these issues only in terms of health or conventional approaches to gender and problematising those, but also to consider access to justice, entrepreneurship programs and the widest range of development topics. We need to work together. We need to work together. And Lee, is there anything you'd like to add? I'm talking to you.
I didn't quite hear the question. It sounded like you're addressing some things I don't know as much about, so I don't think I have anything to add.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, everyone, and thanks to all the presenters. If you have other thoughts, queries, questions, please hear us.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea, the Pacific and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter to get all the latest updates, or you can connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.